Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 187.
This week on the podcast, the Iowa caucus was such a beautiful mess that everyone got to deliver a victory speech.
Plus, now 8 debates in, Ben Carson still doesn't recognize the sound of his name being announced.
So Hillary Clinton's a progressive now? Sounds like we need a new word to describe our politics.
Gloria Steinem proves that even radicals can develop into crotchety old people.
And this week was so crazy, there were even cars being eaten by sinkholes.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right. Oh my gosh, let's go.
This week?
Let's go.
Everything
This was
happened.
The week of weeks.
I know we say that every week.
No,
I feel
but,
like we say that all the time.
Right.
But this week, literally everything
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, well, last week it was exciting because we had all the polls going into Iowa, but now we know what actually happened in Iowa, so we don't have to talk about the Iowa polls anymore because
no,
we can tell you what actually happened.
New polls
and it
in
was
Iowa.
Brilliant.
I mean, new polls to talk about, not
yeah,
in Iowa.
They're New Hampshire ones.
The Iowa caucus was the most exciting it's ever been in its entire history.
It was such a gift.
I don't feel that I'm overstating that.
It was a gift on a lot of levels because, first off, it was a giant clusterfuck.
Huge disaster.
And I feel like it was good for us to know that because we need to take a look at what was going on there.
We finally, I think, as a nation, understand what the Iowa caucus is. And I think that our response as a nation was, what the fuck?
What is going on in here? I know. Well, and it was crazy because MSNBC was like in, and some of the other places probably were too, but that's who I was watching. But they were like in the caucus sites and they were going into like
gymnasiums filled with people,
and then they were like sticking a mic in the conversations like that groups of people were having, discussing, like, you know, the Sanders group trying to get O'Malley's group to come over to them. We heard the F word get dropped on MSNBC while they
that
were
was
doing
an embarrassing
that.
I mean,
like,
for them.
But I mean, it really just, like, the whole thing felt bonkers. And I've been to one of these before. I've caucused
the whole
before,
thing is bonkers,
but it still was crazy. I caucused in the Gore Bradley election, so
which,
like, there was
not anything of this
no,
level of excitement.
There was no excitement going on in that.
No,
but like,
and this, so on top of the fact that at least on the Democratic side, where they have open voting, so it's not a secret ballot, it was you got to see that it was just like random people in a gymnasium in various corners, like standing and shouting at each other.
Yeah,
it had the most exciting results.
The results were great.
And we don't even mean that. You know, we're Sanders supporters. We say it all the time. We don't mean that from a Sanders support perspective. We do to some degree. I mean, I'm excited by what this means for the Sanders campaign. But it was just exciting because it was really close.
But it was a tie in, like,
the most tie-iest
of ways. Yeah.
And it was, because it was a tie and because there was no precedent for this kind of tie happening, really.
Yeah.
You know, that nothing this close has ever been the result of the Iowa caucus. Nobody really knew what to do. Everyone acted insane. And that's what we love about politics the most.
And because it was so close and because the turnout was so high and they were running out of voter registration cards and this and that and the other, I mean, we heard a lot of, we're still hearing a lot of
horror stories
about
bad planning, of overcrowded facilities.
The caucuses weren't staffed. They didn't have people. People were trying to call in the results the next day because nobody knew who was supposed to call them in that night. And then
people ran out of voter registration cards on the site.
The headquarters were closed the next day when they were trying to get the things in. The app was good. Oh,
right.
On MSNBC, they were talking to one person who was like just tallied up her votes and she couldn't get the votes in. Because her phone had died.
Oh, right. Yeah. Classic.
It was like, get the woman a phone charger.
Right.
It was like this old lady at caucus site.
Like, nobody brought a phone charger to the caucus?
Like, that's the level of absurdity we were dealing with at the caucus.
Yeah. I mean, that was what was going on. And with all of that, the final state delegate tally. And so, of course, okay. The voters on the night are voting for county delegates who go to, like, another convention.
Who
and
go
then
to the
vote
state
for state
convention,
delegates. And then the state delegates vote for the national delegates. It's a lot of... So you might have heard about coin tosses. The coin tosses were for those county delegates. There were six county delegates that were decided by coin toss that all went in Hillary Clinton's favor, according to media. But there's now reports
now some discussion
that
maybe that's not what happened.
There were probably a lot of coin tosses.
Right.
Because anytime that there was a tie, they did a coin toss. Which, by the way, this can't be how we're doing this at all.
No.
I don't care if it didn't affect the outcome. That's ridiculous.
Right.
But in any case, the final state delegate count tally was that Clinton had 699.57, you know, sort of assumed delegates. Because, again, the reason there's a fraction is because we don't know how the count, you know, there are sort of county delegates that could go in various directions. Sanders had 697.77. Then, they were both at 50%. Her margin of victory
was, like 49
was originally 0.27%.
Yeah.
Then they did an internal review of the results because it was so close that they had to do a review of it and found that her margin of victory was actually only 0.25%.
Yeah.
So she was leading by a quarter of a percent Sanders.
Yeah. That's and we don't bonkers. Know who, and I heard Sanders, and they haven't said this since then, because I think that they probably, I think it is smart for them to not attempt to push this any further. Yeah, and they talked about this at the debate a little bit, but at one point during the night or the next day, he said that he wanted the party to release the raw voter numbers. Yeah. And I think that's probably because he thinks that he won. Because yeah, in a lot
he
of
probably
these,
did.
Because he the was bigger winning districts in the, he were was the big ones in the bigger that... districts, and he was winning those by a much greater margin. I mean, one of the they were at the they were in Iowa City, which is obviously a huge college town, and the big gymnasium that they were in there, the Clinton was barely viable in that room. Like, she snuck by getting even any result in the room by like a handful
of
people.
This makes sense. Like, you know, more crowded districts always have less representation in any level of politics. That's because it's like Congress explains it best. If you're in a state of seven people, you get one congressperson.
Right.
Also, if you're in a state of like 50,000 people, you still get one congressperson.
Right.
If you're in a state of a zillion people, you get the minimum number of congresspeople that you could possibly get for that many people.
Right.
So somewhere out there, there's a district with hundreds of thousands of people in it that is getting represented by the same number of congresspeople as seven people in another district. Not effectively, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The state of Vermont only has one congressperson.
Yeah.
There are not as many people in that state as there are in my parents' congressional district in New York City. That's how that gets decided. So it makes sense that in a more crowded district, there's less representation because the sort of In the smallest possible district, they still give you a delegate.
Yes.
That's how. And there's parts of Iowa that, like, basically no one lives in. So, you know, that's why they're having coin toss issues.
Yeah.
And then there was, like, there were so many funny stories that were coming out of the caucus sites that were, like, random, like, oh, 60 voters got lost somewhere.
Oh, yeah, right. Like, this yeah.
The Des Moines Register had an op-ed where they called for a total audit of the caucus results themselves, because they were just sort of embarrassed, I think, about how all of this had looked so terrible.
Yeah.
But some interesting results coming out of the caucus. Sanders led voters 17 to 29, so under 30 voters, by a 70-point margin,
that's
according
insane.
To CNN's exit polls. He also won the 30 to 45 demo. Clinton won the over 45 vote by a much slimmer margin, however.
Right.
So a lot
of
just
more of them.
There were just more of them. A lot of people were sort of reporting that this was kind of symbolically important because it kind of meant that Sanders had won the future of the party.
Right.
Like, the future of the party really lies with these younger voters.
Yeah.
And I also saw some later breakdowns that said that he basically won the vote of people who make less than $50,000 a year.
Mm.
Like, that was, there were huge distinctions between income and household income and how you voted. And that, unlike with the Clinton-Obama thing, where, like, poor white people were more likely to vote for Clinton in that race, this was very different because she didn't win all of those poor white districts the way that she had in 2008.
Mm.
And it was actually the upper middle class suburbs of Des Moines and places like that that really carried
her. Going for her.
So that was sort of interesting.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important for us to maybe note here that, like, while it was a tie, that's a win.
That's a win for Sanders.
For Sanders.
Because,
and if you think that that's just us being Sanders fans, that's not the case.
No.
That certainly probably maybe clouds our judgment a little bit. But also, this was a race that he was down 50 points in not long ago. I mean, and as we have always said, I mean, the fact that she is sort of, as much as we love him, the fact that she is now in a very real, intense race with, you know, an aging Vermont socialist.
Right.
Bless his heart.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that, it was a huge victory for him, and it would have been, it would have been bad for him to have got blown out there. And and most of the polls didn't show that happening anyway.
No,
but I was nervous that day.
Yeah, well,
I got to tell you,
it wasn't until that day that I saw any polls that he was even leading her in.
Yeah,
you know, until then he had never led her in a poll in Iowa. So this was a real last minute victory. And I think the other thing that I feel like is maybe worth mentioning, and this might be just me as a Sanders fan talking, but I think it's sort of an important thing to remember, is that we shouldn't, because a lot of the results were sort of skewed towards kind of overemphasizing the point that he didn't win all of the groups that Obama won in all of the places that Obama won.
Right.
And I want to point out that he is not running with the same with the same constituency.
No, we have talked on this podcast actually, it's and not I think the probably I was going to say we have talked probably wrongly about that before because yeah. I think the media has been talking
right.
about
There's
it.
There's been no one talking about anything
because
else.
He's not.
He's not Obama.
He's not putting together the same coalition.
It's not the same
of people.
Coalition of people, and it's not the same kind of election because Obama and Hillary Clinton were really running on the same platform. He was running on hope, and she was running on realism or whatever. But right. they're on the issues. Oh, I just knocked the mic. It's going to be an exciting sound.
Sure.
On the issues, they were very similar because they were both Clinton era Democrats. They were both new Democrats. They were both part of the same wing of the party. So what we had in Obama was a young, exciting guy. He was going to be the first black president.
Right.
But he was not offering a vision that was all that different from hers. He was offering a sort of perspective that was different
right.
than hers. Bernie Sanders is not really offering, you know, sort of an exciting, he's not offering an exciting self.
Right.
He himself is not that exciting. He is offering a different vision, and it's based entirely on policy in a way that Obama's was not. Obama's vision was based on, like, are we optimists or pessimists?
Right.
And we're still having that discussion
we're
in the party, obviously.
Yeah.
But this is entirely about, this is a repudiation of sort of mainstream / center right Democratic politics.
Yeah.
It's not about who's the more exciting person.
Yeah.
And so it couldn't be the same coalition.
Yeah.
It's not, we don't have the same sort of identity politics to play on because an aging white man is not going to offer, it doesn't
right.
offer anything to anyone except maybe aging socialists in Brooklyn. I don't know. But like, it does, there's not like, it's not like the voters are identifying with him personally and
right.
sort of investing in his personal, point of personal struggle.
Right.
They're identifying with his politics. He's
right.
running an entirely issue-based campaign that isn't really about all of this other stuff. And in the process, he's showing that we prefer to be optimists than pessimists.
Yeah.
But like, it's, we can't expect the same coalition to come out for him because of that.
No.
So I think we're going to see interesting things though in South Carolina, where coalitions that we think traditionally vote together are going to start breaking apart. Where I think we'll see younger black voters start to veer towards Sanders because young voters in general are more likely to be pulled into an optimistic
campaign. Well, and he's had some good, you know, he had a South Carolina African American state legislator switch from Hillary to Sanders this week. Ben Jealous, who used to run the NAACP, endorsed him this week. I think that
we're
going to
talk a little bit about
South Carolina.
He's
way behind
up.
In, but it's tightening a little bit. We're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that, especially coming after New Hampshire, which it looks for all the world like he's going to win, and Nevada could be close. I think once we start seeing that this is a real race, that people in South Carolina are going to give him a look, and I don't think he's been given a look quite yet. Probably.
Yeah, exactly.
So, just going back to who won really quickly that night, like, if there is any doubt who won, all you have to do is ask yourself who slept well that night. And who was trying to figure out
who was tossing and turning.
Which staffers she was going to murder, like, you know, in a blind rage.
Yeah.
And also,
who made $3 million the next day in donations?
Right. Well, yeah. And if you, neither of them, I think that they both thought that this was not going to be this close. I mean, the Des Moines Register had it at 3 points going into the day before. Sanders had to change his plane ticket to New Hampshire to stay later. He was intending to leave earlier, and there were a lot of reports that Hillary was planning to have Bill and Chelsea introduce her at her speech, like as if it was a big victory speech.
Mm-hmm.
They did not do that, and she gave a real victory speech. No, and she also had a. There were reports because she was at Drake University of people saying that they removed her teleprompter for her.
Yeah,
and that would be because she had a victory speech in it.
She couldn't give a victory or not victory speech
right.
in this situation.
And that's what both of them did.
Both of them just gave... And interestingly, Hillary Clinton gave a speech that sounded an awful lot like she had stolen it from Bernie Sanders on the stump. She gave a really progressive speech, which was an interesting thing to see.
Yeah.
Which was the moment where I was like, well, she won this. I mean, where he won this. Like,
mm-hmm.
he won because he's running just because of these issues. He doesn't care about actually being president himself.
Right.
If she wins, then she... and uses his platform, then she has won.
Yeah.
One more point, though. There was a weird moment that we saw on MSNBC that I feel like is worth pointing out, where her campaign declared victory before the final results were in, and Andrea Mitchell looked so confused and, like, over it, too.
Right.
She was, like, not having even a moment of it. They were declaring it because there are 6 Iowa superdelegates that have already pledged to Hillary Clinton.
We think that's why she did it anyway.
Well, no, they announced later that that's what...
Oh,
they did
right.
say that later, that that was why she had done it. That is an interesting thing to have happened to have led her to declare what she felt was a definitive victory at, or her campaign was sort of spinning as a definitive victory.
Right.
Because it plays directly into Bernie Sanders's sort of like the system is rigged talking
point.
Right,
because the superdelegates are just basically
important
people.
They're party insiders.
Right, exactly.
They're people that are either, you know, that either work within the Democratic Party or are elected representatives right. at a different, you know, at the national level or whatever. Yeah. So it's just sort of like watching the establishment elect her is exactly what he's trying to show us is happening. Yeah. And so like if that's the basis of them declaring that, then that's already hilarious.
Yeah, because no.
That's another example like,
way,
of them playing directly
way to
into
help
his
Bernie
hand.
Out. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
The Republican race was also very exciting.
It was.
I would argue that the media got a little too excited about what they felt was the demise of Trump.
Yeah, because
we're
I am seeing that already not be the case.
Seeing that as the case. Yeah. Cruz was the big loser because he won and nobody could have cared less.
Right. I know.
It was
the big news.
Nobody gave a shit
the
about
The big
Ted
news
Cruz.
Was Trump losing and it didn't matter who it was to. And yeah. The other big news was that Marco Rubio won by getting third.
Exactly. Yeah. Marco Rubio, I mean, almost surpassed Trump. So that was interesting. He got 23% of the vote. Trump got 24. So that was a close race.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz got 28% of the vote. That's the last I've heard mentioned
of
that.
I said to you that night, I was like, well, this is... I
know, he did a classic Brent Thornburg
thing, and I was like, well, I never thought I'd say this, but I feel bad for Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Because
he won the Iowa caucus and he lost the Iowa caucus. Right,
exactly.
So basically, everybody gave a victory speech in that race because Ted Cruz gave a victory speech. It's the last one he'll ever give.
Right.
Donald Trump only
is the
gives
only one
victory
who,
speeches,
right,
by the
he
way.
He didn't, actually. He gave
didn't.
A very short
he gave a
speech,
vague
and probably
speech.
His humblest speech, yeah. even though it wasn't that humble.
And
but I mean,
said
like,
he might buy a farm in Iowa. That was gross. And then Marco Rubio literally began his speech with, they said this would never happen.
I know.
Which is especially hilarious because he's been polling in third this whole time.
Not
until recently, but I'm saying, they
but not that close, though.
They didn't say this could
he
happen.
He almost got second.
He was only one point off from Trump.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, the amount of, like, overzealous, self-congratulatory nonsense that he opened his speech with was so hilarious, considering that he was giving the third place speech.
I know. Well, and it was so funny, too, because Bill Maher was playing clips of his speech and, like, did this really funny thing where he would, like, play something and then be like, well, actually, they were right, because Marco Rubio kept being like, they said that Iowa wasn't a state that I could do well in. And then Bill Maher was like, well, you're right.
You're third.
They said that Iowa was a state that I wasn't going to win. And it's like, well, you didn't win it. They said, and just like, because he had this big soaring speech about like how everyone had doubted him.
It's like, they were right too.
You just got third, man. Yeah, like, so I realize you did better than you thought you were going to, but
that's not a victor make.
Get a hold of yourself.
That was a funny speech. Also, in the battle of Marco Rubio v. Drymouth. Drymouth is winning. It's really winning.
He didn't have an embarrassing sort
he didn't
of water
take a sip
grab,
of water, but
there was
he had a lot of weird mouth movements where everyone, because they're expecting him to have dry mouth, was like, oh.
Yeah.
Like my mom, who normally texts me to remind me that she's just again noticed how big his ears are. Instead,
well, she did do that.
Well, she did that as well. But she also texted me to be like, is he still having dry mouth issues? They haven't figured that out. So people
were
noticing.
Yeah, mouthwash for that.
Yeah, it's like.
And other things.
If it's an ongoing problem and you are a person whose life is spent in front of cameras, like,
you
figure that shit
out.
I mean, it can't be that hard.
Yeah.
Ben Carson, in what is becoming a slapstick routine of a campaign, basically,
oh my God.
Did not stick around for the results in Iowa. Why? He had run out of clean laundry. He had to go do his laundry.
He had to go back home.
Yeah.
He went to Florida instead of either. Also, like, get some new clothes. Like, there are
do
stores in Iowa.
Else.
Like, I realized, you know, Iowa has sort of a rap as maybe like a, you know, hilariously small podunky sort of place. But, like, there's a mall there.
Do literally anything else.
Yeah.
And that was, like, his official campaign response, by the way, to why he was leaving.
And there was a little scandally situation because apparently Ted Cruz had told like all of his precinct captains
that
or whatever
had
to like
dropped out, right?
that Carson had dropped out, which is because Cruz was not leading in the polls here. And I think the big takeaway that everybody took away from Cruz winning, whether there was fraud or not, as Donald Trump has been shouting all week, but that the evangelical vote there is stronger than even people who have been polling the state for all of their lives can wrap their brain around.
Yeah.
because
well,
that's
doesn't
real,
make any
that,
sense.
Because that's how he won. That's what did it. I mean, those are the people
and
who are voting for him.
And that's not a viable coalition going forward. You don't win the general or really any other state by having the evangelical
maybe a few
vote.
Others.
Maybe
yeah,
a couple
I mean, like,
other
right,
states
yeah,
in the
exactly,
South, but like that's not how you win a general election.
No.
You don't win Ohio with the evangelical vote. Like that's not happening out
that's
there.
That's why we would.
And you don't win the general in Iowa because, again, it's worth reminding everyone that like twice as many people vote in the Democratic primary there as the Republican.
Yeah. The one thing that I will say that sort of I feel like should give Democrats a little pause, and Democrats did have a good night in terms of turnout.
Right.
But we heard all of this talk, and this was obviously, they were just wrong about this, so maybe I shouldn't be so concerned. But they were just saying, you know, big turnout on the Republican side is going to be a good night for Trump.
Right.
And they shattered their turnout records.
Yeah, huge turnout
for
the Republicans.
And it went to Cruz.
Yeah.
So that to me is a little problematic, just because I feel like, fuck, man, they had a shit ton of people out, and they were not necessarily, like, they were
voting
for, like,
they didn't do what
they were
people.
Supposed to do.
No.
So, I don't know. Iowa's,
but there's
like,
also, I think that he, you know, Trump was never really running that hard in Iowa. He was
he
running
wasn't.
A national campaign.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
He
a lot of people
not
sort
spending
of,
his money there. It doesn't, like, I don't,
a
I
lot
think
of people
we were,
blame his ground game.
Yeah,
because he didn't
I
really
think
have
that
one.
He was not expecting, like, I don't think he was doing what you do to win Iowa. So I feel like I don't know that he was that surprised.
Yeah.
A couple other notes. We have some dropouts.
Oh, yeah.
O'Malley dropped out on the Democratic side before the night was even, before we got too excited in, you know, this in the tie. Huckabee dropped out. Santorum got out basically the next day.
After he went home and prayed about it.
Right. He had to go pray
he
on
had to
it.
Go pray
I don't
on.
Know why.
Yeah. Well,
it seemed
at least
the writing was on the wall.
I was, well, you know, this is an instance where God told him the right thing.
That's true.
To do.
God also told him to get into the race, though, and that was the wrong thing.
I know.
God does not have a great track record with Rick Santorum. I don't know why he keeps trusting God. But whatever. That's fine.
He had a little bit of a mishap because he endorsed Marco Rubio almost immediately and then went and did the sort of, you know, press tours like you do after you endorse somebody and got asked why he had endorsed Marco Rubio and didn't have a damn clue.
No.
Not one single clue.
Classic Santorum.
Yeah. So then he quickly had to go figure out
who
why
Marco
it was
Rubio
that
is.
He was right, exactly. Yeah.
Other than a guy he's been sharing a room with at various.
Well, not really.
Debate, well, not sharing a room, but.
He hasn't been on the same stage with him all election season.
That's so true.
Yeah.
also, I feel like I became personally aware that regular media has no fucking idea what's going on. So that I'm now starting to sort of like not understand or trust a lot of reporting that I'm seeing. And
well,
I feel like I'm becoming a conspiracy theorist. Like Brent tried to send me Drudge Report links last week and I was like, stop with all the madness. It's stressing me out. I can't read the Drudge Report, but I'm becoming a personal conspiracy theorist because I heard them, you know, for a while I was sort of like, yeah, this is the end of Trump. And then I noticed that Trump has actually gone up in the polls in New Hampshire since this happened. This really doesn't mean anything for Trump. He was not really, I don't think, ever going to win Iowa. That was not sort of, that's not kind of like where his campaign was focused in any way. I feel like the same was sort of true on the Democratic side where the spin sort of made it seem like this was some sort of like death knell for, you know, Bernie Sanders in a lot of mainstream media. And I was like, that's crazy because this was such an outrageous victory for him. And a lot of his supporters are not hearing about him from mainstream media anyway. It doesn't really matter that that's what mainstream media is saying. They're hearing about it from friends. They're hearing about him from Twitter. They're hearing about him from all these other sources.
Yeah.
So there's almost like not really a place for spin in this race in the same way. But they really like did not report what I felt was accurately on what a big victory that really was.
Well, and I think part of that is to do, and I'm not saying these people can't do their jobs if they don't have. I have been, and I was talking about this with someone yesterday, I feel like I've really been seeing, even with like different blogs, but also even on the news, like where I've, just because of what we talked about in terms of Hillary and Bernie having such different visions, you really are starting to see, I feel like I can tell where even news people are falling.
Yeah.
In the, you know, I mean, like,
it's crazy.
Chris Matthews' hard-on for Hillary Clinton is actually disgusting. I mean, truly. Like, and especially as a person, I realize a lot of those MSNBC people are sort of, you know,
former establishment
partisan
guys.
And, you know, whatever. But, like, you know, that's a little upsetting. And Andrea Mitchell, who I generally like, I think we sort of, like, this election has been forcing me to sort of, like, look at, like, beyond just the people talking to me.
I know, I'm starting to
like,
hear them differently.
Like, it's, you know, you sort of have to remember that she is married to Alan Greenspan, too.
Right.
You know, Bernie Sanders loves to talk about how much he hates Alan Greenspan. I mean, like, and I'm not saying she can't do her job because of that, but, like...
Chris Matthews cannot.
There are... Chris Matthews certainly
can't. Any piece of information that you feed him gets spun as a thing that's positive for Hillary Clinton, regardless of what it was. If it's this poll that we're about to report on where Sanders is up... is doubling Clinton in the New Hampshire polling, he would find a way to like make that positive for Clinton.
And like even things, I see people post things and I'm like, why is this so negative or why is this so positive or whatever it is? But it's like, you know, like Media Matters for America is obviously like shilling for Hillary right now because that's David Brock's thing. I was like, somebody posted something about, you know, somebody posted something really nasty on Blue Nation Review, which is supposed to be some like leftist blog that was like terrible about Hillary Clinton. That's also owned by David Brock's media company. That's like his like, you know, shell company, like that owns a bunch of media. Like, I don't know. I feel like this election has really been like forcing me to look at those things because I'm like,
And even been, I mean, I read the New York Times every day. The New York Times does not have nice things to say about Bernie Sanders for the most part. They find a way to spin everything as positive for Hillary Clinton, like Chris Matthews, regardless of what it is.
Yeah.
And that's been interesting to watch. And I get it. They're establishment people. I mean, that they are the establishment's paper. But it's sort of like I've never had to use the word establishment so much. I'm starting to sound like a conspiracy theorist. And I don't think that I'm crazy.
No, I don't
know. I think that we're really seeing a very interesting discussion emerge within the Democratic community.
Well, and it's happening on the right too, actually.
And it's happening
in its
on the right
way.
As well. Yeah. No, I mean it's happening on both sides. But it's like media that I sort of innately trust. I'm starting to be like, okay,
yes,
guys.
Me too.
Calm down with this.
Yeah, so you know? Like places that I would probably like blindly click on an article for.
Yeah.
I've been sort of like having to question like
the motives of their article.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Probably good to do.
I mean,
but
no,
it is
it's
insane.
Been interesting. You shouldn't have to. But you know, there's no way to report.
No, there's not.
Fully, you know, sort of objectively on these issues, especially.
I would like Chris Matthews to not be doing
Chris Matthews campaign
coverage.
He's not
though.
Doing reporting right now.
No,
he's doing shilling.
And he's anchoring their
coverage
of this.
Crazy.
It's actually really upsetting.
To the extent that like Rachel Maddow has had to be like,
She's lectured him a few times.
She's lectured
she's
him
like,
several
with all,
times. Yeah.
She pulled out a with all due respect on Monday night to Chris Matthews, and it's like
she had to.
She did.
Being a nutbag.
Yeah. Being
in any
crazy.
Case, New Hampshire polls are getting very exciting because the New Hampshire polls. So all of these changes are within the margin of error, but their sort of like general direction is interesting.
Yes.
Because Sanders is up to 61% from 57%. And
this
Clinton
is a CNN poll, and this is post-Iowa.
Post-Iowa. And Clinton is down to 30% from 34%. So he is now beating her by 16 points. I mean, 31 points. Sorry. I read that and was like, it must be half of what I was halving 30. No, it just seemed too large. He's beating her by 31 points.
Yeah.
He was...
There are other polls that show that tighter,
regardless.
I mean, there's not a single solitary
the
poll
that
has it within double digits.
Also, was interesting about this poll and is interesting about all of the polls that are starting to come out after these Iowa caucus results have come in is that they are moving in these directions. They are all moving with Sanders is gaining support and Clinton is losing support. That was something that Herschel's were sort of trying to say wouldn't happen. They're trying to claim that, like, he's not going to have a massive victory there. I feel like, you know, you never know what's going to happen in New Hampshire. People can register to vote in any primary they want at the last minute. So if one of them is more exciting than the other, and I would argue that the Republican primary is way more exciting than the Democratic primary there, maybe we'll see a lot of people head to that primary. But it's 64% of likely Democratic voters said that they've made up their minds. That's only 41% on the GOP side. Only 17% of likely Democrats are saying they're still trying to decide. So... Those are pretty, that's a pretty big margin.
Yeah.
That's not the margin of an underdog.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to look at.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that in the sort of on the heels of her sort of pseudo win in Iowa.
Yeah.
That her supporters haven't really like tried to come out.
And I have heard reports about like how.
She has to win this.
She has to do
that.
Well, and I feel like there have been a lot of reports like because he's ahead so much, like people aren't going to. people aren't going to go and vote in that election or whatever. And, like, I don't think that's how voting works. Like, no. I just don't, like...
Not in a race like this.
And especially, like, New Hampshire obviously, like, prides themselves on being the first primary. I mean, Iowa's the first caucus, and they like to differentiate that and still call themselves the first, primary, you know, whatever, like, semantics.
Yeah.
But nobody who is, like, really into that race is going to be like, oh, well, Bernie's going to win, so I'm not going to take 7 seconds to go, like... throw a ballot in a box.
No, and it's like, also, it's not like the Iowa caucus where you have to show up at a specific place.
Yeah, you can vote all day
long. You can vote any day you want. I mean, any time of day that you want.
Yeah.
So I think we will not see that. And even if we see much tighter margins than this, I feel like this is the state that revived her campaign last time.
I was going
to
say,
and kept her in. She's going to have to wait now until South Carolina, basically, because Nevada is like a fake caucus. I mean, it's a real caucus, but it's like a fake caucus.
Right. And it's on a Saturday. She's not going to get any sort of news bump coming out of Nevada. Also, that could very well end up being close.
No, exactly. So. But she's going to have to wait an awful long time to get any momentum in this in this campaign. And that's not a great thing for the establishment person to be in that position.
Yeah.
Also not a great thing is for the establishment person in the Republican race to be
fighting for second place.
With like 1,000 other people.
Right. And to have that second place be someone who's probably going to lose by twofold to Donald Trump.
Donald Trump has gained 5 points. This is what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Everyone thought, wow, this is the end of Donald Trump.
Right. Donald Trump's whole campaign is based on being a winner, and now he's not a winner, so the whole thing is going to come crashing down around him.
But unless he gains 5 points in New Hampshire, which is what he's done, and he's now at 33% there. Rubio is at 16% there. That's not a surmountable obstacle.
No.
Rubio's not going to win the New Hampshire primary. No. Well, he might also not even come in second because Cruz is at 14%. Kasich is at 11%. Christie and Jeb and a whole bunch of other people are in the high single digits.
Yeah, there was another poll actually that was
Christie was actually in the double digits, I think, right?
And Bush.
And Bush too, was,
There's all of those guys are in the basically like 10 to 16 point range, depending on what poll you look at.
That's not a good position for Rubio to be in, especially after the debate that we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Crash and burn.
Yeah, because he kind of crashed and burned at the last Republican debate.
Yeah.
So second place is super up for grabs.
Well, and it's super up for grabs, and it's also, it's important probably, I mean, Rubio wants it because he wants to continue to be able to say, look, I'm the establishment guy, like, I'm doing the best. Like, these other guys, you know, needed to do well in New Hampshire. They didn't. Don't vote for them. It's over for them. You know, whatever. You may even see some of them drop out. It wouldn't surprise me if Christie gets fifth or sixth. It's like, happens next for Chris Christie? Yeah. Nothing. I'm not convinced I know why Ben Carson is still running either, especially after getting, you know, fourth in Iowa.
But have we ever known what Ben Carson was doing and why? I mean, we never understood
that. Well, it was to win Iowa. That's what his plan was.
Was his plan his plan, or was it our plan for what his plan should have been?
Well, he was ahead there for a while.
I know he was ahead there for a while, but was that why he was in the race? I mean, there's so many questions with him.
But the other, besides Rubio, who has already done well in Iowa, those other guys feel like a second place finish is sort of a ticket out of there.
Yeah.
Like, if you're John Kasich and you get second place here, even if it's by 20 points, like, then you feel like there's a reason for you to continue living, basically.
Well, and
like,
you make a real play for the establishment money at that point.
Right.
Because they're starting to throw money into Rubio's campaign. Rubio himself is not really delivering on that money and that investment.
Right.
So there's room.
All the people who gave him money between Monday and Saturday
are hating themselves.
I was going to say, saw that debate the other night and are like,
hate their lives. Man.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I could have told them that this would happen. Because he's never been an engaging speaker.
No.
But in any case, if you become a second place contender in New Hampshire as an establishment guy right now, this is your moment.
It's your way out.
It's your way
basically.
Out.
Yeah. Like, you get to keep going from there.
Yeah. So this is going to be a very exciting Republican race.
Yeah, for sure.
The Democrats finally had a debate on a Thursday.
Guys.
It's like, we finally made it.
Right, and we're going to have
more,
too.
We're going to have more now, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bombastic debate.
Let me tell you guys, this debate gave me life in so many ways. Because besides the fact that the 30 minutes arguing about progressivism, which we're going to talk about more in depth in a second, besides that, we talked about the death penalty. We talked, I mean, it was just like
all the things,
everything that I was like needing in my life was like right there for
at
all
the
of
debate.
The worlds at the debate on a Thursday night with only the top two people. I mean, it was just like, it was, there it was.
Yeah.
I saw.
Didn't miss O'Malley a bit?
I probably saw 30 or 40 minutes of it and then had to go to rehearsal and then came back and I was like, well, I obviously have to watch the rest of this and didn't know where I had left off because so I was like, well, I guess I'll just start it over. So I watched like the first 40 minutes of it twice. Well, and you know what? I felt really fucking good about it too.
Because the first 40 minutes were all about who's more progressive. And that's minus the fact that I'm about to maybe lay into Hillary Clinton for trying to redefine what it is to be progressive instead of actually being progressive.
Yeah.
It is so thrilling as a lifelong progressive to hear a discussion in which people are trying to be the progressive in the room or trying to meet that definition of progressive, which is a thing that I have wanted all candidates to aspire to. And no candidate has ever aspired to being called a progressive in my life. Like to hear that the two candidates who are running for president for the Democratic ticket in a year where the Republicans are in shambles and we have a very good shot at actually winning this thing want to be called a progressive is like,
well, and they both, what I would say is that they, while I was really upset by her sort of redefinition of what being a progressive is, I thought they both, part of the reason why this was so fascinating was because A, it got a little heated, but B, I thought they both did a really good job because I think what she is trying to do here is pretty genius, actually, because she's trying to redefine what the word means. She says being a progressive is somebody who makes progress, which is not, at least politically, I mean,
that's not
if you look it up in Webster's, I mean, perhaps maybe that's what it is. But like, we all can sort of agree that that is not
being politically progressive.
That is not what the word means. But then she sort of went on, you know, she said, I don't think it's progressive when you talk about, you know, when you vote against the Brady Bill five times. I don't think it was progressive to vote to give gun makers and sellers immunity. I don't think it was progressive to vote against Ted Kennedy's immigration reform. And that got huge.
That was the moment
in the room.
That was her moment.
That was the moment in the room. She also said, you know, under your definition, she was basically like getting on his case for sort of like, you know, being the gatekeeper of progressivism. And it was sort of like, under your definition of progressivism, Obama isn't a progressive and Joe Biden isn't a progressive. And
now, some of us would say, yes, you're
I know. And I was like, I'm sure that's I'm sure that's what he wanted to say. But
he couldn't say that.
But that
was a genius line for her.
Yeah.
They all said the word progressive about 1,000,000,000,000 times.
Yeah.
I started seeing tweets that were just people saying progressivism is the progress of progress. And the it was just like people making fun of.
Yeah.
It was tweets entirely composed of the word progress and progressive.
Yeah.
So that was obviously also like a hilarious thing that happened there. She also sort of in sort of like trying to lambast him for being progressive, she called him out for smearing her, which is another thing she's been up to.
Yes.
That is maybe smart in a sort of PR sense, but totally disingenuous.
It is. Well, and also it didn't get, that got jeers in the room when she said that. Well, when she said,
I think it's time to end the very artful smear that you and your campaign have been carrying out in recent weeks.
And the whole room was like,
they were not having that.
Because
the smears are coming in one direction.
Yeah.
When you smear someone about the facts, that's not a smear. That's just a fact that you're having.
Yeah.
And there was also a weird thing that happened where she said that he was attacking her, and she talked a lot about how he was attacking her in this debate, and said, you know, that he was putting for time and again by innuendo, by insinuation, there's this attack that he is putting forth, which really comes down to, you know, anybody who ever took donations or speaking fees from any interest group that has to be bought. And I just absolutely reject that, Senator, and I really don't think these kinds of attacks by insinuation are worthy of you, and enough is enough. Meanwhile, as she's saying this, her campaign sends an email to reporters saying that he's getting dark money from a nurses union. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but that was a very sort of like disingenuous general campaign moment.
Yeah.
It is not the same thing to have nurses union support you, a nurses union support you, as it is to ask nurses unions to give you money that you are not reporting.
Yeah.
That's not the same thing. In any case, there were some interesting conversations though. There were some interesting conversations about, you know, where she was really taken to task about being a member of the establishment. Yeah. I love that establishment is a dirty word now. That goes along with my love of hearing progressive bandied around quite as much as it was. And Sanders said, Senator Clinton does represent the establishment. I represent, I hope, ordinary Americans. And by the way, who are not all that enamored with the establishment. And then Clinton tried to sort of spin that. As Senator Sanders is the only person who would characterize me, a woman running to be the first woman president, as exemplifying the establishment.
I mean,
This is sort of like her redefining what it means to be progressive. Establishment is not being a part of the establishment or not is in her case, especially not right. like her gender, you know, gender does make it harder for you to be a part of the establishment. Yeah. I get that. Her gender is almost like secondary to her establishment ties because they come from all directions with her. She's married into the establishment, but she herself is an agent of the establishment.
She has been
supporting establishment, you know, proposals and the establishment sort of like line in the Democratic Party herself. So like whether or not she feels a part of it, she is an agent for it.
Well, right. And not only is she, I think what people often forget because it was a while ago, but I mean, she is not so much part of the establishment as a co-creator of the current establishment.
She is a leader of the establishment.
I think it's important to remember that because, you know, what the Clintons did, and, you know, we can talk about whether the Clintons are progressive enough or not until the cows come home. I would say no. You know, they did a lot of good things, not just in winning the presidency, but I mean, in sort of, you know, pushing the party back to the center, it did allow us to sort of get more House seats and more Senate seats at the time. And the
reason
the reason that they sort of created this new kind of Democrat is because out of the fear that we had gone too far to the left for the general mainstream. Yeah. I would say that the mainstream is now
moved
with
to the left,
yeah. and they are still wherever they were in the fucking 90s. Regardless, where we are now as Democrats is, she's not just sort of like vaguely in that.
No, she guided us
there. She created it. She took us to where we are currently now. So for her to say that she's not in the establishment because she's a woman, you fuck off. Yeah, I mean, sorry. I don't know what else to say other than like you're just a lying sack is what you are. I mean,
it's
sorry.
Just,
my rage level's getting high.
We've
again.
Discussed I mean, Brent's growing rage with Hillary Clinton.
But like that is low.
This is low. No, I mean, but this is, you know, it's low to try to redefine what it means to be progressive.
Right.
Her campaign has now become just like a campaign where she tries to redefine things.
Yeah, she's making things up.
She's just
now
making
is what she's
random.
Doing.
Yeah, she's redefining words that are popular to be
to fit her,
and that's not.
Right.
What, you know, it is exciting that a woman is sort of this close to the candidacy for president. Like, it's exciting that she is this much of a behemoth of a candidate, that a woman has sort of reached the role of being the establishment candidate.
Well,
it is
true.
Not.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Sure.
It is not exciting for me that the establishment is the establishment, though. I mean, there is now a sort of different foe in this race, and the establishment is that foe. It's not. It's not like you get to just be like, I'm not a white man, so the fact that I hold positions that are mostly gonna, you know, improve lives for white men, like, is not important. Like, we're voting on her politics.
Right.
That's a victory for women.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll get into it. We're getting accused of a lot of things.
Yeah.
As, you know, as members of the left at this point.
Yeah.
A lot of.
Well, and you specifically as a woman.
As a woman, a young woman on the left that I have some thoughts about later. But I mean, this is just sort of like, this is sort of her strategy now. She's taking all these things. She's trying to redefine herself as something that the voters want. So she's trying to be like, no, I'm progressive, but she's not. And she's trying to be like, no, I'm not establishment. I'm a woman, but she is establishment.
Right.
And she's not trying to be not against the death penalty. That, by the way, I don't know how big a moment. I haven't seen that part of the debate. It was a really controversial thing on Twitter. I was following the debate on Twitter, and that got a lot of comments.
Well, this I bring this up as one of the reasons why I dislike her. It's not an issue that I would ever vote solely
on.
You know, I would not be a single issue person on this, but like this is on the list of things that I don't particularly care for about her. And it always surprises people when I say that she is for capital punishment. Everybody always looks at me like, what?
Yeah.
And so that was another reason why I was excited about this, because I was just sort of like, well, this is a good thing for people in the party to see, because this is not, she's in the minority with her own party on this one.
Yeah.
And I thought her answer was actually fairly thoughtful, but I mean, it was still.
It's a non-starter issue, though, I feel like, even if
well, and it was a great answer. Moment for him, too, because he was able to use that in a, I mean, he had a great quote, and he said, in a world of so much violence and killing, I don't believe the government should be part of the killing, which was a great line. But he also talked about how it disproportionately affects the poor and minorities as well, which was good for him to get in there, because that's 100% true.
Yeah.
So that was, I feel like, one of his sort of more shining moments.
But Twitter was not having her point of view on this. It was sort of interesting to watch. Because there were, like, moments where there were, like, flare-ups during the debate.
Yes.
As I was following it on Twitter. There was, you know, there was a lot of flare-up during that progressive conversation. There were some flare-ups during their foreign policy conversations. And the death penalty, which was just, it was not a big part of the debate, but it was a huge flare-up on Twitter. Yeah. The email controversy, I'm over. He's over and I'm over. He's over.
Right.
He's over. I'm sick of them having to talk about it at these debates. It's one thing for us sort of in public to sort of have this information come out and debate the merits of, you know, whether or not there's anything fishy there. But I'm sort of like, I don't need her to be asked about this on a campaign
trail. There were a few, I was going to say, I mean, I don't want to stay on it too long. But I mean, they did ask her if she could say with 100% certainty it would not be an issue in the general election. And she said yes, which I feel like is sort of bold.
Yeah. Well, why not be bold? She's losing a campaign that she was supposed to win. So right,
exactly.
Be bold.
And there was also she did that thing that we talked about a couple weeks ago on the podcast where she was talking about all of this retroactive classification.
Yes.
Which where is basically a knock on the State Department because that's who's doing that.
Her own
people. And the current administration is basically who's looking at those things and then like marking those things. So it's a it doesn't you sort of like have to dig deep into that statement, but it's such an odd thing for her to do because that's basically like
that's her department.
Yeah,
that was the one she led.
So that's odd.
It's weird.
But anyway,
They had interesting exchanges about Wall Street.
Yeah,
Sanders hit her on the sort of deregulation in the 90s that happened. He didn't hit her directly on it, but that was sort of happened under Clinton and was part of her sort of like New Democrats platform, if you will. And also brought it back to campaign finance reform.
Yes,
which was. As always, a dream.
He crushed it on campaign finance reform because there was a question about that. And he basically said, you have to walk the walk on this. And when she sort of got into this place where she was like, you know, basically what you're saying is that anybody who takes campaign funds from anyone, you know, is not to be trusted. And she was like, and I just disagree with that. And she was like, you won't find one vote that I changed. Meanwhile, of course, everyone has been passing around the clip of her, that story that Liz Warren told about her with the bankruptcy law that she had, that Clinton had fought against forever. And then as soon as she got elected into the Senate, she voted for it.
Yeah.
So she's lying again, obviously, but regardless, like, and his answer to that was really good too. He was like, and that's where this 90s thing came in. He was like, if you think that the reason that we deregulated in the 90s wasn't because of money that the big banks and Wall Street was giving, then you're crazy. If you think that the reason why we haven't been able to get X, Y, and Z done is because, you know, do you think the reason that we can't get the Republicans to agree that we're having climate change right now is because fossil fuel industries aren't pumping money into the political system? And he, like, did another really good job explaining this. And I feel like he's getting better every time because we talked after the last debate that he sort of is finally
finding. Well, this is, I mean, that's why I wrote that thing on our blog and also posted on HuffPo this week. That was an idea that Brent gave me actually, that was about how this is sort of like the mother of all the other issues. This is the only issue. Campaign finance reform is what prevents us from getting everything else done.
Right.
So even if you have even if you do have a progressive record on other issues, if you don't have a progressive record when it comes to campaign finance reform, you are not getting those other things done. You're not for getting them done because you're not for doing the thing that helps, that will get them done.
Right.
And so that is sort of like something he can connect every issue back to because it's the reason that we have inaction on everything.
Yeah. And he's doing a good job with it too. He's getting better every time.
Exactly.
Because it's not hard, but I mean, it's a complex issue. It's not just saying, I stand against this, or I stand for this. You have to, there's an explanation that goes along with that.
Also, it's a really boring issue. And it's super boring to have to bring up at an exciting, you know, when you're like on stage and everyone's excited and
somebody
starts
talking about campaign finance reform. It's like you're
like
go
snore immediately.
And then,
it's the most boring issue on the planet. That's why no one is dealing with it.
Right.
As usual, the sort of the weakness for him in the debate was foreign policy.
Yeah.
She kind of, I think, finally found a quippy line that she could say in response to him talking about her Iraq war vote.
Yes.
I don't think it solves the fact that she did it or has bad form.
Either.
And he did, at a certain point, sort of like remake our point that experience and good ideas are not the same thing.
Yes, he absolutely did.
Which is what we've been saying this whole time. But she said in response to his criticism on the Iraq war vote, a vote in 2002 is not a plan to defeat ISIS.
Yeah.
Which is finally at least something she can say in response because she'd sort of been, she'd sort of like been changing the subject a lot when that came up.
And
that, and, you know, she does have more experience on foreign policy. That is an area where she sort of should be trying to take the reins in this campaign. Yeah. And she's been sort of failing at it, largely because she has a very bellicose sort of record on foreign policy anyway. And that's not really what voters are looking for right now. Yeah. Bellicose. I said it.
I know.
I have like good vocabulary, guys. I didn't just sit and read books in a room for 3 years and not get a good vocabulary. But I think that's, as much as this really should be a like clear win for her, and if for people that are really focused on foreign policy, it is.
Yeah.
It's really not where voters' heads are at right now.
Yeah.
So she's been having a hard time sort of like staking out a claim to anything on the basis of this issue.
Well, and she sort of walked herself right into this thing about Iran, because they were talking, because Sanders had said,
oh, right, where she called Obama naive years ago. Right,
because Sanders has been saying that we should continue to try and normalize relations with Iran, and Hillary sort of like got on his case about that, and he was like, well, I didn't mean that we would just like, you know,
go in
do
there
it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And he was like, by the way, in 2008, when you were debating Obama, and he said that he wanted to try and do that, you said he was naive, and that's how we ended up getting this deal that we got right now.
Yeah.
She, of course, said that's not exactly what she said, and then tried to explain what it was that she was actually saying. But, like, that was a pretty good jab that he got in.
Yeah.
That I saw coming a mile away. It's like, why are you doing this?
Yeah, don't
like,
bring this up.
This is
Stop
not,
talking about it.
Right? Like, I know the answer to this, and I'm not a professional politician.
No, exactly.
So.
She did, again, try to assert that he wants to get rid of Obamacare.
And his response was very clear. Very concise and very pointed in its obvious annoyance with her, because
this is a fucking fraud.
Right. This is a fallacy that she's like trying to sell to everyone that like he's going to get elected and then he's going to like tear up all however many thousands of pages
said,
Obamacare is.
There is no disagreement between us on universal coverage for healthcare. Well, there is.
Yeah.
There is a difference between she's not really advocating universal coverage if she's advocating a hobbled together system where we have private insurers and not everyone ever makes it into the system.
Well,
and that's
the thing. I feel like I know that he's uncomfortable running against Obamacare and he wants to sort of like make it more pro, you know, single payer. But I think to do that, he's going to have to tell people what's wrong with Obamacare.
Yeah.
And I think he finally started to do it. And I was glad because he was like, well, we have to understand that 29 billion people are still
without insurance,
without insurance on Obamacare. We have to understand that even more millions of people are underinsured under Obamacare.
Right.
Also, they're going broke trying to pay their bills. So I think that
he has to
throw Obamacare under the bus at least a little bit, or else this argument for single payer doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
Because we have to know why we want single payer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's probably true. I think it's something that he can also build to, because I think that's kind of what his strategy has been.
Yeah.
He kind of started by just saying single payer, waited till everyone found out what that was.
Right.
Now he's kind of explaining, like, no, we need single payer because even though we have Obamacare, Obamacare is not the same as single payer.
Yeah.
In any case. Side note, he mentioned the 50-state strategy.
Yeah,
now, we all know that I love the 50-state strategy, and I've been waiting forever for any mention of it. I wait all the time for mentions of the 50-state strategy.
Yeah.
So I'm on board for that. I sort of wish that she was also talking about a sort of larger Democratic strategy, because I think...
But she wants a smaller strategy,
Unlike Sanders, she's in a real position to immediately make something happen by declaring that that's a strategy. Because she kind of has the ear of the establishment, and they are the people who are pushing money into those smaller races.
Yeah.
So she could make that a priority and kind of try to become the people's Democrat without having to change any of her horrible positions on things.
Yeah.
And it sort of boggles my mind that she doesn't try to run with that strategy, because turnout benefits Democrats in a general, regardless. When Democrats vote, Democrats win.
Yeah.
That we say that all the time.
Yes.
But that's the truth. There are more Democrats in America than there are Republicans. They are not divided evenly throughout the country, so there is not fair representation of them, but there are more actual Democratic voters.
Yeah.
So just by mentioning the 50-state strategy and encouraging the 50-state strategy, which he's doing from an outsider's perspective, and so he can only really do it informally in terms of like just sort of encouraging people as a person, by his presence to get into the race.
Yeah.
She really has the ability to make that change immediately a thing.
Yeah.
And that has always frustrated me about the Clintons anyway, but is especially frustrating.
Yeah.
And their sort of like, you know, and their peons, if not their peons, they're scions. What am I even talking about? So they're people. Yeah. The Al Gores of the world, the John Kerrys of the world. Yes. There are other establishment candidates. You know, Howard Dean is the 50-state strategy guy.
Yeah.
But aside from Howard Dean, none of these Democrats have really been actively pursuing that strategy for much.
Yeah.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz certainly isn't. No. And I feel like this could be a thing that drives votes to her if she played it right.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I think it's dumb of her to not sort of be part of this discussion. Yeah. In any case, that's just me.
Before we leave the Democratic debate, I want to talk briefly about one part that was probably the funniest, at least for me, part of the night, because they asked Bernie about the fact that he has run against Democrats before, because we know, he's an independent. And there was a specific race where he was running as an independent. There was a Democrat and a Republican in the race, and the Republican won, and they asked him how he felt about being the spoiler and whether he felt bad about the Republican winning. And he was like, well, Rachel, the Republican got such and such percent, and I came in second right behind him, and the Democrat got such and such percent. He was like, really, the Democrat was the spoiler. And it got like a huge laugh and applause in the room. I mean, he's right. Just because you're an independent doesn't mean you're the spoiler. The older I get, the less I abide by the whole spoiler situation. Well, if 10% of the people were convinced that they were supposed to vote for the Democrat, then they did the right thing. I mean, that's how I am starting to feel.
I don't say this a lot, but I have family in Florida that voted for Ralph Nader.
Yeah.
And they were not sorry about it.
No.
Because they were Al Gore did not do what he needed to do to earn my vote. And you're right.
That's what I always tell people, too. Because, at the time, I was like everyone, sort of, railing on Ralph Nader. And looking back at that now, I am able to have perspective that the reason that Al Gore lost in Florida and other places, including his home state, was because he was a shit candidate.
Yeah. No, exactly. He had chosen a shit candidate to run with.
Yes.
He didn't. Knock the mic again. I get excited about this. But I mean, he didn't earn their vote. Anytime that you are not seeing people vote with your party, it's because you haven't earned their vote.
Yeah.
You have to earn their vote. You didn't. That's sort of what I haven't liked about the tone of Hillary Clinton's campaign this whole time.
Right.
She has to earn my vote. If she hasn't earned my vote because she's saying that my one issue that I care about more than anything in the world, which is single payer, is not possible and will never ever happen, so we can't talk about it anymore, then she hasn't earned my vote. So I don't have to vote for her.
No.
That's why when people ask if I'm voting for her in the general, I say no. Yeah. I'm not going to not vote, by the way. There was a discussion today that made me worried that people are thinking that when I say that, I think I'm saying I'm not going to vote.
You're not voting.
I would never not vote. Only a complete idiot doesn't vote. I mean that. You have to be an actual idiot person to not vote.
Yeah.
I am saying that I will vote for a third party candidate, that I will vote for Jill Stein, or if some other candidate that catches my fancy were in the race, I would vote for them. I mean,
I actually this year have thought, I mean, I'm still obviously holding out all the hope in the world that Bernie wins this thing, but I have been thinking that this may be the first time that I've never voted for a third party candidate, but I will work for her.
Yeah.
Actually.
Oh yeah. No, I mean,
and by her, I mean Jill Stein.
Jill Stein. Right. I think that the conception that you owe a party or a candidate your vote is inappropriate. It has no place in our political discussion.
Yeah.
And that anytime that comes up, I'm very suspicious of the party that it comes from or the candidate that it comes from.
Well, and also I feel like this year in where it's obviously such an anti-establishment vote, I feel like that if, I mean, I don't know how to say this without saying that I want the Democrat to lose in the fall, because that's not what I want at all.
Right,
I want the Democrat to win, even probably Hillary Clinton, even if I don't vote for her. But I feel like on some level, if the party needs a wake up call.
Yeah.
And if the wake up call is that too many people voted for Jill Stein, then so be it.
Well, and that's
and I'm probably going to get some shit
but also,
for that
that's
from
not
some people,
on us.
But it's not on us. No,
that's
it's not.
That's not on us.
And
that's
I would sleep fine.
Yeah. It's not on us. It's not on us that more people didn't vote for Al Gore when he was the candidate, because it wasn't our job to vote for him if he wasn't saying what we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
It was their job to figure out what voters wanted. That's the same with any candidate.
Yeah.
So it's not on us, whatever happens. We can only vote the way that we want to vote based on the principles that we hold and the priorities that we have.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to vote for a candidate in this race that isn't in favor of single payer.
There you go.
There it is.
Did it.
That's my line in the sand. In any case, exciting news. They're going to do, CNN got the next debate because, you know, they extended the number of debates they were going to have. They're going to do it in Flint.
Yeah.
Like we said,
exciting.
They might.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, exciting.
Yeah.
They did mention Flint in this debate, but I mean, there's not much disagreement between the candidates about what they should and shouldn't be doing, because anyone with a heart knows that the federal government should put as much, as many resources into that situation as possible. And the many other water quality and other living quality situations that are coming up all
coming
over
up
the nation.
Yeah.
Something like, I read that 16 counties in Pennsylvania have higher lead in the water rates than Flint. So, or 16 towns in Pennsylvania. In any case, this is, infrastructure issues are worth looking into, guys, and are going to be, I think, a big part of this campaign going forward.
I agree.
South Carolina, some preliminary numbers. These are pre-Iowa numbers, so we don't really, no one's really polling South Carolina, I feel like. I feel like all we do, we hear polls about New Hampshire every 5 seconds, and every, like, month someone bothers to poll South Carolina. Yeah. The race is tightening, but it's still a, you know, there's still a big gap.
Yeah, it's Clinton, 62 to 32.
Yeah,
so
62 to 32.
But
so
that is shrinking.
Margin, but that's shrinking.
I mean, he was behind that far in some of these other states to begin with.
And he's just in the last couple of weeks started to get some big endorsements in South Carolina.
Right.
So I think that we'll start to see those numbers shift as people's familiarity with him starts to rise.
Yeah.
Because that's what I think, if New Hampshire showed us anything, it's that if you know about Bernie Sanders, you like him.
That's right.
Because they knew about him because they are in a neighboring state, and they liked him immediately. He's been polling great there
since
he declared.
Yep.
That's what gave him this sort of start in the race to begin with.
Yeah. But he got some good endorsements. He got a...
The former chair of the Democratic Party in South Carolina endorsed him.
Yep.
And said Hillary is not an agent of change. I mean, her campaign slogan should be, "It's my turn."
Yeah.
He's a little controversial.
I like ours better. I stopped dreaming.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one.
That's our new campaign slogan for her, which I think is a little catchier.
He said some controversial things about Nikki Haley in the past, but I kind of like him for it. He said at one point during a gubernatorial debate there that the Democratic candidate would send Nikki Haley back to wherever the hell she came from.
Oh, boy.
Also once compared her to Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress.
God.
In any case, a state rep there, Justin Bamberg, also endorsed her. He's the lawyer for the family for someone who was killed by a police officer last April, Walter Scott. And he endorsed him last week after having initially endorsed
Hillary
Clinton.
That was actually big news.
That was big news.
And also, just recently...
And it was literally about the dream rhetoric. That's the he said, "We live in the greatest country on earth. We put a man on the moon. Don't tell me we cannot provide Americans with the right to health care because this right is a matter of life or death for many Americans."
Yeah.
I mean, it was literally that don't dream rhetoric that got
him. This healthcare thing has pissed a lot of people off.
Yeah.
I mean, it's especially the activist, the people who are like, I mean, 81% of the people, we keep referencing this number, like that's the last poll, like of the party, say that they want single payer healthcare. So like, I don't understand what her plan is here. It doesn't make any sense to me, but we've already gone over it, so we don't need
and
to do it again. But I mean, it's not surprising that people are switching to Sanders over it because
single
like
payer healthcare,
as soon as she said it, they were probably like, "Are you kidding me, lady?"
Yeah,
like,
exactly. No, and also this might be totally wrong, but my sort of impression based on how the Republican Party has been voting and what issues they've been voting on aside from racist issues is that And in discussions with people that are much more conservative with me and don't like Obamacare, what I have realized is single payer is significantly less controversial than Obamacare. And I don't know why that is. Hmm. But even on the right, you have this sort of like libertarian end of the right that doesn't want the government to do anything. But what their real issue with Obamacare is that it forces you to buy a private product.
Right.
You aren't buying anything with single payer. It's just a thing that we all have.
Yeah.
Your tax dollars pay for it. So it's not the same thing as the government mandating that you purchase a product with your own money.
Right.
It is a thing that is provided by the ether.
Yeah.
So,
well, and I think so many people
left,
or center, everybody hates their insurance company.
Everyone hates their insurance company. I know. It was when they were first arguing for Obamacare, they would use this line like that nobody's going to be forced to switch, a doctor or insurance company that they love. And I was like, who are these mythical people that love
their
insurance company? I've never met an insurance company I loved.
Yeah.
I've had many insurance companies in my time.
No, they're all equally
and
as terrible.
All of them
as
have
the
been
next.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Some of them have been worse than others.
Yeah.
Some of them have been downright evil, but they're all terrible.
Yeah.
So in any case.
Yeah.
And we also mentioned before that Clinton's camp, as one of their smear campaigns, sent an email out to reporters during the debate last Sunday that said, and this is related to the healthcare discussion, which is why we're bringing it up now, that Bernie Sanders doesn't have, was saying he doesn't have a super PAC, but that just isn't true. He's benefiting from the support of a super PAC and a, quote, dark money group currently spending money on his behalf. The group they're referring to is the National Nurses Union, who has spent $900,000 on independent expenditures in support of him. And they've also organized buses and things to go down for him.
The email
doesn't mention that it's a union, though. Right. It's a union, and it's also transparent because it's funded by dues that are paid by their members. It's not like mystery millionaires are donating that money. That money came from nurses who are in favor of single-payer healthcare.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue that they cite as the reason they're supporting Sanders is single-payer. So... That's a ridiculous thing that happened this week.
Here's another one.
Yeah, here's another one.
Oh, God.
This is the big sort of Twitter controversy of the week.
Yeah.
And one that I got real into.
You should have.
But, so Hillary Clinton, one of the angles that she's pursuing in order to sort of get back the support of young people is that she's some sort of like feminist icon.
Right.
And so she's sending sort of her both feminist and... not feminist, but impressive women shills out to kind of make this point for her. So Madeleine Albright has been on the trail with her. She introduced her at a rally in New Hampshire as the first female Secretary of State and made a dig at the sort of revolution rhetoric that Sanders employs, saying that the first female commander-in-chief would be a true revolution. And she said, "We can tell our story of how we climbed the ladder, and a lot of younger women think it's done. It's not done." Which, and then said, "There is a special place in hell for women who don't help other women." Whoa.
Yikes.
That's rude.
Yeah.
Especially in the same week that Gloria Steinem...
I'm assuming Madeleine Albright probably voted for John McCain and Sarah Palin.
Or then she must have.
Potentially Michelle Bachmann.
She must have. She had no choice. There's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. Exactly. So
there it is.
She's probably a big Thatcher fan, too.
Yeah, she might be.
Yeah, she might be. That's true. And she, you know, she's a feminist icon because she's the first female Secretary of State.
Of course.
Not a feminist icon because she's a feminist. She's not an activist, is what I mean.
Yeah.
Gloria Steinem is famous for being a feminist activist. That's why we know her name.
Right, exactly.
And she was on Bill Maher on Friday and said, and suggested that younger women who are backing Sanders, which they're doing by a pretty large margin, are doing it so that they can meet men. She said, when you're young, you're thinking, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie. This is part of this Bernie bro myth. I'm getting sick of this conversation, by the way. He disowned them this week, finally.
Yeah.
But this is not a real thing, the Bernie bro. I'm sure that there is sexist rhetoric being used against Hillary Clinton in this campaign. I have no doubt.
Yeah.
That is not the bulk of Bernie Sanders' support, though. That is not where his support is coming from. It's not coming from sexist men.
No.
That's some bullshit.
I was going to say, like, he's not running a campaign of misogyny. Like, that's not what...
And the implication that that's what's happening is disingenuous.
It's
and
ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's also building a larger wall between Hillary Clinton and young women.
Right.
Because, first of all, Bill Maher was like, now, if I had said that they're for Bernie because that's where the boys are, you'd swap me.
Yeah.
He's not wrong.
No.
It started a Twitter shitstorm because fuck her for suggesting that young women don't care about issues and that young women don't have appropriate priorities.
Yeah.
There is... a lot that I can say about Hillary Clinton's platform for women. It's quite good.
Yeah.
The other thing that I can say, though, is that feminism is an issue that intersects with a lot of other isms.
Yeah.
And that young women, by and large, are voting on those larger isms. Because it is, and this was something I was saying to Brent earlier, and it's a point that I think I've made before on the podcast, but maybe not. If you are voting just on a platform of women's issues, but on a platform that also doesn't address the other isms that disproportionately affect women... then you are voting for white feminism. You are not voting for women. Because women are disproportionately affected by a lot of poverty issues. They're like most of, when we talk about income inequality disproportionately impacts women. When we talk about housing discrimination, it disproportionately impacts women. There are
healthcare
issues disproportionately impact women.
Yep.
The sort of larger world of issues that Bernie Sanders is addressing when he talks about income inequality and other kinds of inequality, racial inequality, you know, and gender inequality, which he has been a great advocate for his entire career.
Yeah.
He is talking about issues by and large that she is not talking about that disproportionately impact women. So a vote for Bernie Sanders is not just a vote for feminist causes because he's been an advocate for women in the past. But it's also a vote for the larger universe of causes that disproportionately impact women, but also impact other people.
Right.
You can't just be a feminist in this world. I understand why in the 60s you know, Gloria Steinem was just a feminist.
Right.
I understand what it would be. I mean, I don't understand, but I know that it would be frustrating to be born into a world where you literally couldn't make basic decisions about your life and where there wasn't this sort of larger unity and understanding about how these issues are intersectional.
Yeah.
But to imply that young women are not serious and are not thoughtful because they are not blindly voting for a female candidate over one issue when they understand that this issue has implications for, or that that other issues have implications for women and that right. those issues are not being addressed, is just fucking yeah. low.
Well, and she realized had to take it quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had to take it back. On Sunday, she issued an apology where she said, in a case of talk show interruptus, she meant this, though. This was yeah. a crotchety old person thing to say, and she meant it. I misspoke on Bill Maher's show recently, and I apologize for what's been misinterpreted as implying that young women aren't serious in their politics. Whether they gravitate to Bernie or Hillary, young women are activists. Young women are activists and feminists in greater numbers than ever before.
Yeah.
Because that's what I think has been maybe understated by a lot of the Hillary shills of this generation, including people that we would otherwise think of as radical, is our generation is really fucking radical. We're an exciting generation. Like, this is what excites me about young people right now. You know, you hear a lot of bullshit about millennials in the press yeah. because everyone loves to hate whoever the youngest, you know, generation is. Yeah,
of course, that's been going on since the
dawn of time.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. If you think that old people were saying nice things about the 60s generation when that was happening,
right.
you're wrong.
Yeah.
But also, actually, I was thinking about this recently, and one thing that you can't say about Hillary Clinton that you can say about Bernie Sanders is she was not radical in the 60s, so she doesn't get to own this 60s generation feminism. She was a Goldwater gal.
Yeah.
Like, Bernie Sanders was part of that.
Right.
So that's how he got to this place of greater understanding about both how women yeah. needed rights and also, and those were fairly misogynistic movements in the 60s, a lot of them.
Sure.
You know, the civil rights movement was a very misogynistic movement.
Yeah.
Black women get left behind in every movement because feminism was Gloria Steinem and, yeah. you know, the civil rights movement was Martin Luther King. And there was sort of like no one in there to be like, what if you're black and female?
Yeah.
But this is not a support. This is not a voting for Hillary Clinton is not voting for the candidate who addresses even first wave feminism yeah. issues yeah. because it's just a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
In any case, I was really mad that she even thought to go there because she was not going there without other, like, this is a sort of direction that Hillary's campaign has been
yeah.
going in.
Yeah.
But also, as a complete side note,
yeah.
for the woman but who relevant. Thinks that we should, but relevant, for the woman who thinks that we should vote for Hillary Clinton blindly because she's a woman. One woman that she didn't support was Zephyr Teachout, who was running a very legitimate challenger campaign to Andrew Cuomo in the New York governor's right. race.
Yeah.
So, and that was just last year. So, come on. Slow your roll.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In any case, this is a big controversy of the week that explains yeah. why Sanders is leading Clinton with young women 18 to 34 by 20 points.
Well, and I think this could only backfire because already my Facebook wall today was just littered with stories of millennial women, groups of millennial women, who are just writing all these pieces of like, look. I'm a millennial. I'm consider myself a feminist.
And I'm serious
and I'm,
about
and
issues.
And I'm serious about issues, and I'm voting for Bernie Sanders, and fuck off Gloria Steinem.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and that is only going to, that's only going to draw more women, I think,
yeah.
to the cause.
No, this is also, old people accusing young people of being idiots is well, not a,
never,
a way to get them to
not
vote
a winning strategy.
No.
Yeah.
They'll stick with their 74-year-old socialist. Yeah. Also, though, our 74-year-old socialist was on SNL.
Oh, yeah, he sure was.
That was fun.
With Larry David.
With Larry David.
yeah.
And directed a Bernie Sanders spoof.
yeah.
with Larry David.
Yeah.
So that was funny.
The GOP.
There was also a GOP debate.
They didn't want to get left out of the Saturday debate.
No.
Game.
They thought we'd like to have a debate that no one watches. We
right.
weren't doing enough of that.
Yeah.
So they went for it.
Yep. They did.
Politico. First of all, Debbie Wasserman Schultz tweeted something smirky about it being on Saturday and got a ton of flack on Twitter. That
as
was hilarious.
As she should have. Yeah.
Politico basically termed this debate the time that Chris Christie beat up Marco Rubio and took his lunch money. Because the main story of the debate was that Rubio was not good.
Yeah, all of the headlines were just like,
he was at the top of the firing squad because he's got all the establishment money
right, so all
flowing
the,
into his
those
campaign
four
at the
people
moment.
That we talked about earlier in the podcast are all going at each other to try and get second place. Yeah.
The HuffPo headline chain, because you know they do those excessively long headlines, was genius, though. So I want to just read the whole thing, because hey, why not? It begins with, Markobot gets stuck in infinite loop, gives same canned answer three times in a row, then uses it again.
Yeah.
Christy clobbers, crowd goes nuts, cringeworthy, exposed for the wind-up doll he is. Won't be easy for his campaign to reboot. Brit Hume says, like Dan Quayle.
Yikes.
And then flashback column, is Rubio secretly a robot? A column they had written, previously.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's so
good. You don't
want
the Dan Quayle reference, by the way.
That's like, that's
not a
dark.
Good sign.
Yeah.
According to Politico, they were talking to a bunch of insiders that went anonymous because they were about to say really mean things about their party's establishment choice, called Rubio cringeworthy, badly programmed and robotic, so rehearsed he comes off as inauthentic and exposed at last for the wind-up doll he is. Then another anonymous hero says he was sweating so much he looked like he needed Charlie Crist's fan blowing on him.
I like that. That's a good throwback.
He basically, normally he goes on about Islamic jihadists, but he had a canned zinger about Obama that he just like whipped out multiple times, even after Chris Christie called him on it.
Yeah.
And then he said it after that again because he just like couldn't think about anything.
Well, and Chris Christie all week has been,
he was on a zinger.
Leading up to this, his entire week has been aiming to take down Marco Rubio in this debate. He's been calling him the boy in the bubble all week. And he just, he was itching for this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really, this was.
He bullied him hard.
Yeah.
He also said Rubio had blasted him for not showing up in New Jersey until 36 hours after that big storm that just happened.
Oh, yeah.
He said they had to shame you into going back. And Christy said, the shame is, Marco, that you would actually criticize someone for showing up to work. Because Marco has been getting a little flack for not showing up in the Senate.
So good.
He has a D- in Senate attendance.
Yeah.
So he just isn't at work most of the time. The funniest moment of the debate was the first moment of the debate.
Yes.
This was the greatest moment in maybe all the debates.
It's so good.
And it was like the most Ben Carson moment that's ever happened.
It was.
It was like, he looked like a lost child like he does. Even after 8 of these things, nobody apparently knows how to enter a fucking debate stage.
Right. So
if you haven't seen the clip of this, just look it
up. Just watch it.
It was so funny that SNL didn't have to embellish it.
No, they played it on Weekend Update, and they were just like, we're going to play this for you. Yeah. And that was all that. They didn't even need any commentary on it.
So Ben Carson is announced, but clearly doesn't hear his name. So even though he was pushed out by a stagehand, he sort of waits in
there.
The like entrance hallway.
Yeah.
Just
but
like,
the camera is on,
the camera's on
there
him.
Because they're showing
that's
everybody
where everyone's
like, make
is.
Their walk.
So then Jeb Bush comes out. Or no, then Ted Cruz comes out.
Yeah.
And it sort of like looks at him like, hey man, what's
and
going on?
And he was like, he
and
even like goes like, go. Yeah. Yeah.
And Ben Carson just like, stares no, dumbly just, ahead. No. Yeah. A stagehand comes out and is like, go, go. And he's like,
no.
Then Donald Trump gets called, also misses his cue, stands outside with Ben Carson as Jeb Bush comes out and is like,
and
the hell are you guys doing
gives
here?
Gives them a look like,
gives them a look
what
like,
is happening out
stop
here?
This immediately. Was the first and last moment he ever got one up over on Donald Trump.
Totally.
And then passes them as they stare aimlessly in this hallway on camera, like not going onto the stage.
How did they finally get out there, by the way?
I don't know, but they also forgot to introduce Kasich. So it was like real chaos. I think probably because they were so confused about what was going on. Yeah, I don't know how they ended up actually getting out there.
Yeah.
I think finally someone was like, go on stage right now.
Get out there.
And we're just going to forget to call Kasich while you do that.
Yeah.
It was a sort of interesting debate for Trump because he kind of toned down some of his craziness and at times almost sounded reasonable. Not like reasonable like we'd like him to be elected, but reasonable for him.
Yeah.
He hasn't outlined his fabulous health plan that he's going to offer us.
Yes.
But he did sort of acknowledge that he wasn't going to leave people dying in the street. So that's his plan that he hasn't thought of yet is going to involve not having people die in the street, apparently.
That's
he
good.
Said, there will be a certain number of people that will be on the street dying. As a Republican, I don't want that to happen. We're going to take care of the people dying in the street. You're not going to let people die sitting in the middle of the street in any city in this country.
That's great.
Always likes to talk in
We're going to let them die in a hospital and then charge them for it.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is the system that we're currently operating
under. Cruz also, by the way, was like a non-entity at this debate. Basically just like kept his head down because he's not going to win the state. And also he had got embarrassed because they mentioned that his people had been telling Ben Carson supporters that Carson had dropped out.
Yeah.
So that was embarrassing. The media sort of continued to report that Trump's candidacy is crumbling. polling continues to tell a different story. Yeah. I don't know what to make of any of this. But Politico described him as, the Donald looked wan, thinner and more chastened after his humbling Iowa defeat. Like an El Greco version of himself. He's still the front runner, but he's lost his maverick swagger. And now he has that flop sweat whiff of a tired horse harumphing into the home stretch. Moreover, he seemed un-outsidery, reasonable, and reasonably well-informed, painstakingly offering a defense of eminent domain, the governmental practice of seizing private property or public or private for a public or private development project.
Yeah.
That's because his casinos in Atlantic City were all conceived of thanks to eminent domain.
Jeb Bush went after him.
Jeb Bush went after him. There was a weird exchange. So he got really impassioned about the eminent domain issue, which is, like campaign finance reform, the most boring issue on the planet.
Yeah.
He said, you wouldn't have roads, you wouldn't have hospitals, you wouldn't have anything, you wouldn't have schools or bridges. That's possibly true. You also wouldn't have private casinos in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
What he neglected to mention is in his grandiose statements about the importance of eminent domain is that in his case, he's so excited about it because he used it for private gain.
Yeah.
And that's not in the spirit of eminent domain.
Roads.
Bush came down on him for it, though, said what Trump did was use eminent domain to take the property of an elderly woman in the strip in Atlantic City. That's not a public purpose. That's downright wrong. I'd agree. I'd also agree that's not a Republican talking point because pro-development people are always for eminent domain going to private parties. Trump basically told him to hush, and he did.
So he did.
And then Trump got booed for telling... he got booed for telling him to hush, but then... said the RNC told us we don't have all the donors in the audience. The reason is they're not loving me is I don't want their money. I'm going to do the right thing for the American public. I'm interested that he keeps going back to what is essentially a sort of crazy person's version of campaign finance reform every time it gets challenged.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I wanted to bring up out of that exchange. Yeah. But that is interesting to me. And it's interesting to me that there is an audience for that. And that's why I think that there is an audience for a lot of the more radical elements of Sanders' platform,
I agree.
Even as we pretend that there's not. I think these Trump people, they're looking for campaign finance reform, some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them are just looking for racism. Yeah. But some of them, I think, are Republicans who are like, we've got to get this money out of politics because they think that the money is affecting Democrats.
Yeah.
And there's only one candidate who's actually offering an alternative.
Yeah.
In any case, Trump's also going to bring back waterboarding and a hell of a lot worse, according to his speech at this debate. And also later, his...
followed up on this and stuck with it on Meet the Press.
Yeah, on Meet the Press.
Was on. Yeah. Because he wouldn't tell us what a lot worse is.
No.
They asked him
he doesn't have details about a lot of his plans.
They asked him what a lot worse was, and he said, I'm not going to define it for you on this program. Probably too scandalous.
Yeah, no. A lot worse is scandalous.
Yeah.
A lot worse than waterboarding. So in any case, we're going to return to torturing people under Donald Trump. Also, Ted Cruz, not even bothered, because he doesn't think waterboarding is torture.
That's right. Not under the current definition.
Not under the current definition.
We're not ripping their organs out.
Right. That's you gotta be really specific when you're talking about torture.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't want to talk about something broadly that is torturous.
Yes.
And describe it as torture when it doesn't meet the legal definition of torture.
Yeah.
That's not what
we
do here.
No.
Not if you're Ted Cruz. Not if you're a debate champion, Princeton debate champion Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
He would never. Yeah. He said he wouldn't bring it back in any sort of widespread use.
Oh.
But that's he didn't say he wouldn't bring it back
in any use. And this is the thing that he has been accused of doing, is like sort of trying to have both sides of the issues.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Rand Paul
accuses... Well, that's a debate move.
Rand Paul accuses him of this all the time. Did he drop out?
I don't know.
I think he did.
Did he?
I think so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we forgot.
We forgot.
He was so forgettable that we didn't even know that he dropped out. So easy to forget.
Yeah.
Well, bye.
I think he did.
I think he did too, because I think I was sort of lamenting the fact that he was actually bringing an interesting... conversational perspective to the debates, even if he was being a crazy person himself.
Yeah.
Because he's the only person on the Republican side that I sometimes agree with on specific issues.
Right.
So I like to have him in there causing trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In any case, here's some exciting news.
This is a good one.
Black Lives Matter is not going the route of Occupy and trying to be just a sort of like dispersed group of thinkers.
Yeah.
They are running for office. They are, which is very exciting.
Get it.
There's a, I think what is his name? DeRay McKeeson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who is someone that we're following on Twitter, who's a big activist. He's about to run for mayor of Baltimore, I believe.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other people from the Black Lives Matter movement who are running either for Congress. One of them is running to unseat
state offices.
One of them is running to unseat somebody. I think also in Maryland. Is that also in Maryland?
Yeah, and that's actually, that's a Democrat.
They're running in a primary. They're primarying Democrats. But the sort of beginning moments of this are exciting, I think, because we're finally, I think, seeing how in the sort of like aftermath of radical activities, how a movement like Black Lives Matter can sort of find multiple ways to make change. Like that's, I think that, you know, and that was something I still argue that Occupy was a very exciting movement and an effective movement, regardless of the fact that it didn't amount to,
I think it sort did of what it was
to specific
to.
Political I mean, actions, but it did exactly what it was supposed to. It changed the way that we talk about issues. It's the reason that Bernie Sanders has a legitimate campaign
this
here.
This election would not be what it is right now if we had not
absolutely
had
not.
Occupy Wall
if Street we weren't talking about the 1% and income inequality. But I am excited to see a movement that was sort of similarly kind of like ad hoc organized out of an issue that was impacting people at the moment turn into something that is also politically relevant in the sort of traditional sphere. Yeah. So that's, I think, really exciting. And agreed. Especially in Baltimore, I think that will be a sort
that'll
of
crazy.
A crazy right. addition yeah. uh-huh. to the race. Yeah. They have a,
he's already raised a crap ton of money. Too,
yeah. They already have raised a ton of money. There's I think somebody from the Green Party also running on a similar platform somewhere else.
Yeah, it's in in Minnesota.
In Minnesota,
this person is running, and basically just because they want to challenge the status quo, and they're just like, I'm not going to count out any party, so they're running on the Green Party ticket, which I think is a pretty genius idea, actually.
But yeah, no, as far as McKesson, he's already raised $57,000.
Yeah,
and
just like this week,
just
basically.
Declared this week, so I think that'll be exciting.
Yeah,
and if all of that wasn't crazy enough. There was even a sinkhole that swallowed a car.
Another sinkhole. They're happening all the time, guys.
They're happening all the time. They're everywhere. They're coming for you and your family. This sinkhole was in Peru. And
it ate a car.
It ate a car that had a family of three in it.
Right.
They had to be rescued out
of
the sinkhole. They got them out. Thank God.
The water was rushing into the sinkhole. The reason the sinkhole happened is because they've had like a bunch of like crazy rains and stuff recently there. So the ground is
just
collapsing.
It was 9 feet deep. It was just 9 feet of sinkhole.
Yeah. And a car just right into it. It was like 16 feet wide, I think. And then...
Or there was a burst sewer pipe, I think, is what...
Oh,
they had been having rains,
was.
But there was a burst sewer pipe that caused this specific...
Yes, had been having a bunch of rains and stuff there, but yes,
guys,
it was sewer pipe.
Sinkholes are everywhere.
Right, and you know who's having a lot of burst sewer pipes?
City of Los Angeles?
City of Los Angeles, that's
it. A place where sinkholes are probably next.
Probably next.
We have nothing but sand and then water from burst infrastructure pipe, I mean, from burst
that's
pipes
it.
Just
yeah,
rushing in
that's
everywhere.
That's what we have.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to my car being eaten by a sinkhole because I think my car is adorable.
It is cute.
Yeah.
We both have cute yellow cars.
Yeah, we both have cute yellow cars. But I also would like to see infrastructure improvements for other reasons.
Well, yes.
I have so many reasons for that.
Yeah.
In any case, New Hampshire is on Tuesday.
We're going to have a podcast for you on Tuesday because next Monday is President's Day.
Yeah.
And we're going to record, I think, on Monday instead of Sunday.
So
you'll be hearing us on Tuesday.
You'll be hearing us.
So you can listen to us Tuesday morning to get yourself ready to do all the things that you're supposed to do.
No, because it's this Tuesday.
Oh, we're going to have results.
We're going to have results this Tuesday.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's
happening fast. We're going to have, we can talk about Nevada that week.
Yeah, because Nevada is right after.
The 20th. It's the Saturday after. And we might go.
Yeah, we might go. Yeah. But we're going to be on Twitter and other social media.
Yeah, of course.
Sources. And we'll probably post something about the results because we did that for the Iowa results. If you want to take a look at what they were, it's up on our blog. And it's about to get really exciting, guys. It already is really exciting. This week was almost too exciting.
Yeah.
Too many things happened this week.
It was a lot. Yeah.
But we'll talk to you next week we'll be posting Monday night of next week because of President's Day, and we'll talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.